Mr. Evans, reel three.
It was agreed upon, provided the commanding officer could have the use of his services at any time, and so that's how it was. He stayed with me then until I was wounded several months later. And after the war, many years after the war, I went back and I saw him in Ghent with my wife. And we had a wonderful reunion at that time. And as we left, he gave me a brown paper parcel and said, "I want you to have this." And we didn't open it until we got in the car. And it was the painting that I refer to. And as we sit here now, if you look to your left, that is the painting. We went on from we went on from there. I was now commanding B Company of the 1st 5th Queens, and we had various adventures, including a an encounter with a fighting patrol from the Germans on the Albert Canal. It was a time when things quietened down a bit, and people were allowed to go back for 2 days' rest. And I had my company was on the Albert Canal. I left it in charge of the second commander, whose name was Cox, Captain Cox. When I came back, all dressed up in my best uniform with brown shoes and so on, I found that the company were under siege by a German fighting patrol which had come over. They had already shot dead an RASC corporal from one of the store, from one of the trucks. And I took over at that position when this lad had just been killed. There was a forward observation officer from the Royal Artillery, FOO, in his tank there. And I asked him if I could use the tank. And he said he'd have to get permission. So he got permissioned. And then he said, "Well, I haven't got a gunner." So I said, "Well, I'll come in, I'll use a gun." I was with the 7th Armored Division. I'd never been in a tank before in my life. Anyway, I went in this tank, and you had to press down a pedal, actually, to fire the thing, and the tracer showed you the direction of the thing. And so we trundled off into this field, and we more or less knew where they were. So we raked the entire hedge where the Germans were, and in a very short time, they all stuck their hands up and they came out. And such was the accuracy of my firing that I didn't touch one of them, but I must have frightened the life out of them. And they came out, and so we captured this entire fighting patrol. I did something which I was fairly well ashamed afterwards. I lined them up, and the NCO in charge on the right, and there were about 20 of them. The NCO in charge on the right looked a very nasty bit of work indeed. And they just killed this man and wounded another. So I went up to inspect them. And as I stood opposite him, he stuck his arm up and said, "Heil Hitler." And I instinctively struck him. And I broke my knuckle, as you can see. And out he went, which was not a very sensible thing to do, and something I never did again, but it was almost instinctive, I think, due to the fact that this person had been killed, and I just reacted rather badly.
So it was a punch?
Yes, with a punch. I tell you this because of the sequel. General Horrocks, who was the corps commander, came onto the scene about 2 or 3 days afterwards, visiting the battalion, And Colonel Freeland brought him up to the company position and introduced me as the company commander. And General Horrocks said, I see you've hurt your hand. How did you do that? And I said, it's nothing very much, sir. I just knocked it against something. And he said, what did you knock it against? And that left me a little stumped until I saw the commanding officer's face over General Horrocks' shoulder, and it was perfectly obvious that he knew exactly how he damaged my hand. So I just grinned sheepishly, and that was the end of that. But it was a rather peculiar little incident. Well, then, from the Albert Canal, there were several battles. There was one at Lunop Sand, which I could talk about, but which is very unusual, where we lost an entire platoon.
What was the name of the place?
Lunop Sand, L-O-O-N, Op, Zand, Z-A-N-D. They were actually sandhills, inland, but quite positive sandhills. And there we were pushing on rather rapidly, and we didn't really have time to study the ground very much. So I sent forward a platoon with a radio set, and we had a signal, red, white, and blue, as he on the map, a certain map reference, he reported red. On the second one, he reported white. And he reported white, but we never got the blue. So it was pretty obvious, actually, that something had happened. We had an artillery officer with us. We could see the Germans in position. So we marshaled ourselves ready to attack. We got the artillery officer to bombard the position with artillery. And we rushed in. The Germans retired, and we found one man who had got away, one of our men who had got away from this particular incident and had hidden in a bush. And of course, the poor devil had been right in the middle of all this artillery fire. But apart from being shocked, he was all right. And he said they'd been ambushed. We certainly heard no firing. They'd been ambushed and taken away. Well, the odd thing was that the firing, of course, there was firing. I mean, they were firing at us the artillery. But there'd been no firing when they were actually captured. But the odd thing was, when we got on the objective, we found the platoon commander's watch. His name was Doug Sadler, and to the best of my knowledge, he's still alive. He came from Woking. And we found his watch, which had been... the strap had been broken by a bullet. It was jagged, and it was lying there, and it was covered with blood. So we really felt, that he probably had been killed, or possibly. But he wasn't. He was wounded. And he was taken prisoner, and he came back after the war. And I actually met him after the war. But it was rather an eerie sensation finding this watch, I remember. Anyway, that was another little battle. The big battle was the Battle of Susteren in Holland. Lots of things happened, lots of battles, lots of small battles, lots of incidents. I'll tell you about one or two of the incidents first, and then I'll just give you a resume of the battle, and that'll be the end of the story. We got into Germany at the village of Wehr in Germany, W-E-H-R. And we were there for the last Christmas of the war. The BBC correspondent, Frank Gillard, came up And he took a tape recording from a corporal in the front line, in a trench, in Germany. And that was the last item of the Queen's speech. You know, the Queen speaks at Christmas. And she made contact all around the empire and so on. I think they still have the empire then. And the last item was interview with this corporal in the front line in Germany. And this was with Frank Gellard. So that was done, and then we came out of the line, and we had a concert, because it was, we had a company concert. It was extraordinary how much talent we had. There were five officers, so myself, second in command, three platoon commanders, then there were sergeants, and then the men. There were probably about 90-odd men, 90-odd altogether. And we had this little place just over the border from Holland in Germany, and it had a small stage, and I think it was sort of a nightclub type of place. So we laid on this concert, and there was lots of beer floating around. You know, it was Christmas time, and it was very amusing, really. The officers did an old-fashioned melodrama, which I'd been engaged in previously, and we had one of the officers who was the old doddery old man, and one of them was Ermentrude, who was at his feet, and she was saying, the squire is coming for the rent and so on, and he's, and the old man was saying, oh, I can't manage that, I will have to do away with myself. And she was saying, say not so, Papa, you were still as strong and lusty as when I was a little gal. And then on came the terrible squire. And of course we were in this little German village, so we had all the props, you know, we had cloaks and wigs and all the rest of it. So I had to come on as a squire and say, aha, you know, take you away to my den of secret vice among the bluebell woods and so on. And she was suitably terrified. And then the pièce de résistance, really, was the second in command, the captain, second in command, who came tearing in, wearing a blue silk blouse with a red sash, and his hair smarmed down, and he was the hero. His name was John Franklin, lovely man. He came on as the hero, and he was supposed to say, unhand yon fair maiden from your foul fingers. And, of course, the moment he appeared, everybody roared. I mean, they just went out, you know, they just fell about laughing. And I had to tell him out of the side of my mouth, wait till the noise comes. So he had to say it about six times. Eventually he got it out, unhand yon fair maiden from your foul fingers. And, you know, it was uproarious. I mean, you know, the officers, they're all making idiots of themselves, but knowing full well that when it came to it, that that everyone respected everyone else. And so there we were. 3 weeks after that, they were all killed except me in one battle, and I lost my arm. But then it was a party, a Christmas party. One of the things I remember most about that was we had a blonde corporal, and he had agreed to do a striptease. Well, Frank Gellard would remember this. I know Frank Gellard's still alive, but I've never contacted him since. But if you know him, he'll remember. We stood at the side of the stage, and this corporal rather tall, slim corporal. We'd fitted him up, or they'd fitted him up with brassiere and all the rest of it, and a wig, and he was powdered up. And they had the usual music for a strip tease. And he was taking things off, and the men were howling there, watching him. But we knew that the pièce de résistance, as far as he was concerned, was that he had to pluck a rose from his pants. And the whole thing was going to drop off, and he was going to be nude. But in order to enhance the effect, he had tucked all his own bits and pieces up underneath his thighs so that when it dropped off, it still gave the appearance of a woman. The only trouble about that was he had to keep his knees together. And the trouble about that was that he was so absolutely scared stiff that he'd been drinking too much beer to give him a little courage. So he was doing this dance around these, and a little tottery because he'd had a few. And, of course, Frank Gillard and I knew what the position was, and we were absolutely flat out on the ground. And anyway, eventually, of course, he plucked this rose away and it all dropped, and he succeeded in his objective, shall we say. So that was the last Christmas of the war. And then we came back out of Germany into Holland. And this was in the part of Holland, at the very south of Holland. If you look on the map, there's a little tit at the bottom where you've got only about 6 or 8 miles, I think, between Belgium and Germany. And we were in that part near Sittard. So we came out back into Holland, and then the battle then was, the operation was Operation Black Cock. Operation Black Cock, which was really to open up the River Maas area prior to the crossing of the Rhine. And we were given the task, the company were given the task of capturing a small town called Susteren, S-U-S-T-E-R-E-N, Susteren. And we were due to attack at 2 o'clock in the morning over snow on the 17th of January, when everyone really should have been in bed comfortably, but it was, we had a great difficulty in getting to the start line. There was quite a battle at a place called Vlodbeek before we ever got there. Anyway, having got there, we were due to leave then at 2 o'clock in the morning. And the trouble was that we were under snow. And we didn't have snowsuits. Well, someone back at division decided that it would be a help to us if we had what they call artificial moonlight, which is to have the searchlights on the low cloud, which reflected light. But from our start position, we could see the outlines of Susteren quite clearly. And if we had moved forward, we would certainly have been seen, without any doubt, as these dark figures coming over this white background in this moonlight. So I requested that the start, that we put it off until the divisional or call searchlights were switched off. And that took some time. Eventually they switched off, and we attacked at 4 o'clock in the morning. And we decided to try and infiltrate at that time. Now, there were two choices, actually. There was the corps artillery, and Agra, which is all the big stuff and everything else, was lined up on Susteren. And the idea was, if we did not succeed in getting in by infiltration, then they would bring the whole lot down, and then we would charge in afterwards. In the event, we got within 15 yards of the objective before we heard the Germans shout. Having learned a little by this time, having been in battle for many months and fought several battles, we knew what to do, and we immediately rushed in, screaming and firing from the hip. One or two of us firing from the hip, but the others absolutely screaming. And we had already done this on one or two occasions, and it was a marvelous ploy, because it just, the people on the receiving end just froze. You know, they just froze. There was no reply at all. We just charged in there. We took 37 German prisoners without losing a man, without losing any casualties whatsoever. And we established ourselves, as infantry people do, in a town, by putting platoons in corner houses, facing up and down streets, so you've got a field of fire up and down the streets, which the Germans know, of course, as well as we do. And our tanks were unable to come up to support us because of the dikes and one thing and the other. They were supposed to support us, but they couldn't get up. So when dawn broke, we found that we were again cut off. The tanks couldn't get up now because of the enfilading fire from the flanks. And we suddenly realized that in this village, this small town, we had three German tanks who were waiting for the dawn. They were useless at night. And they immediately proceeded to knock down all the corner houses on top of the troops. Which made life very difficult. We had a private Howard who, with a Piat, which was our only anti-tank weapon, very heavy thing that one carried. He knocked a track off one, for which he was later decorated. And the Germans thought we had taken over their headquarters, but we were much wiser by the time we'd reached Susteren after all these months. We didn't do things like that. We went into small places, and the house we went into was a small semi-detached council-type house, and it was the fourth from the end of a row. And when we established company headquarters there, everyone was told that they must approach it only through the gardens at the back. And so we were tucked away in this little headquarters. Two of the tanks, in fact, came up to where they thought we were, and they destroyed the house opposite us. And they were literally within 15, 20 yards. And one of them was, they both put their heads out to talk to each other. And this was rather too much to bear, and I'm afraid one of them lost his head in more ways than one. In the meantime, I was on the wireless on the 18th set to battalion headquarters. Say, for God's sake, get the troops up here, or get some tanks up. We were told they couldn't get them up. So I said, well, we're being destroyed. We're going to be decimated here because we have these tanks and the Germans are getting ready to counterattack, which they did eventually. The commanding officer, he was a deputy commanding officer. He was the acting the commanding officer. Colonel Freeland was away from the battalion, and this was the second in command, Major Jock Nangle, N-A-N-G-E-L-E. And he came back to me and said, John, there's only one way we can do it. He said, that's to bring down the AGRA, that's the core artillery, on your position to try and knock the tanks out, because this had already been laid on in case we didn't get in initially. He said, you're the man on the ground. He said, what do you think? And I said, well, anything is better than this, because we're going to be, just killed off one after the other here, as things stand. He came back again. He said, right, we've arranged it. And he gave me a time when it all had to happen, when it was going to start, this bombing, this shelling of the town. So I sent out runners to all the platoons and told them to get well underground, that this shelling would start at a certain time, to get down into basements and protect themselves as best they could. And at the time, a Lieutenant Stone, one of the platoon commanders, arrived through the back door of this house while I was standing, looking at my watch, ready to go down into a little basement myself. He burst in and he said, everybody's they're all underground, sir, he said, and they're all in good heart. And I said, right, well, get down there, which was because I could see the time was up. And he said, well, I better get back to the platoon, sir. And I said, get down there. And I stuck my left arm out. And that's how I lost it. I don't know what it was. It might have been the first shell of the Agra, which would have been very bad luck. But it's more likely to have been one of the tanks having seen Stone come into the house, or having realized that when we fired at their tank commander that we were there. Whatever it was, there was an explosion. It hit my arm. I went round in circles and fell down the stairs. I landed on top of Lieutenant Stone. And he'd been killed with the same blast. So I sat in this little cellar, and in there we had the company headquarters clerk. There were two or three people, quartermaster sergeant, I think. I realized my arm had been hit. I couldn't feel anything at all at that time. So I sat down on a chair beside a small table. It was a very small cellar. One could just about stand upright in it. I sat down on this chair and nursed my arm, and gradually the feeling came back, and it was very painful. I was nursing that there, everything was going on above. The house was hit, you could hear the rubble come down on top of us and so on. And I thought there was a very fair chance we were buried alive. But after a while, there was a tremendous explosion when something hit the rubble above our head. A shell, I should think, from the size of the crater afterwards. It hit the rubble above our head and found its way into the cellar. And it shrapnel ripped down my back and through my thighs, and my back in particular. But because of the position in which I was sitting, although if you saw the scars on my back, you would wonder how on earth I survived, they were slicing blows. They came down and sliced through the flesh. Trouble was, of course, that the cellar filled with dust and the smell of cordite, and everyone was choking. And I stood against the wall and thought, this is how it's going to end.